moving through the valley. The size of the enemy force dismayed the clansmen. It seemed to stretch and swell across the valley, filling it. There were few horsemen, the mass of fighting men striding together, bearing round shields painted black and red, and carrying long swords or vicious double-headed axes. Galen was worried. For the last day he had been convinced that the companions were being followed. Agwain shared his view, though when Gwalchmai and Lane scouted the surrounding woods, they found only animal tracks. Onik and Ridden, anxious to push on, accused Galen of needless caution. That night they made late camp on open ground and lit a fire. The moon was hidden by a dark screen of storm cloud, and the night covered them like a black fog. Galen was glad of the darkness, and curled into his blanket. Onik had suggested they head for Carduel, a jagged, unwelcoming series of peaks to the east, and Galen had agreed. The companions had moved south at first, hugging the timberline, gradually veering towards the distant mountains. Tomorrow they would head into the rising sun over the most dangerous stretch, wide valleys with little cover. Making a cold camp in a hidden hollow, Galen took the first watch. After an hour, Lane moved through the darkness to sit beside him. "Can't you sleep?" asked Galen. "No, cousin. I wish you'd brought Rendar with you. I feel uneasy." "He's well trained," said Galen, "but he's still a hound, and his hunting might have alerted the Aenir."
"It is not the Aenir that concern me," whispered Lane.
"You were still thinking about the wolves?"
"Aye, and the beast which killed the queen."
The moon cleared the clouds, and Galen looked at his friend. Lane's hair glinted silver in the moonlight. Galen shivered.
"You think they might be demons?"
"I hope not," said Lane. "But if they are, and they continue to follow the child, then I fear for Lennox." Galen put his arm around his friend's shoulder.
"If any man can survive against such beasts, Lennox will. I have no fears for him."
Lane smiled.
"He is uncommonly strong."
For a time they sat together in silence. Then Lane spoke again.
"Did you propose to Diva?"
"Yes. She spurned me."
"Me too. Some nonsense about birthing kings. I think she'll grow out of it. Will you continue to court her?"
"No, Lane."
"I shall. Once we have crushed the Aenir, I shall pursue her with such ardour that she will melt into my arms."
He grinned, looking suddenly boyish again. Galen smiled.
"I wish you good fortune, my friend."
"I think I'll get some sleep now," said Lane.
"Lane,"
whispered Galen as his friend rose.
"What?"
"I never really thanked you for standing up for me on that first day, when Agwain drew his knife. You made me feel welcome among the Farlan, and I'll not forget it. And if ever you need me, I will be there for you."
Lane said nothing, but he smiled and then moved back to his blanket.
Galen kept watch for another 2 hours. Then he woke Ridden.
"You have ruined a fine dream," muttered the clansman, sitting up and yawning.
Galen crossed the clearing and lay down. Sleep came instantly. But a faint rustling brought him awake. Was one of the others moving around? He took a deep breath, releasing it slowly, and listened again. Silence. No. There was the sound again. Away to the right. An animal. A bird. Galen curled his hand around the short sword lying next to him, gently easing it from the leather scabbard. He felt foolish, thinking back to the first night he had spent in the open with Caswellan, when the fox had terrified him. A crunching noise, followed by a bubbling gurgle, brought him to his feet, and the clouds above moved away from the moon. A scene of horror met his eyes. 5 huge beasts were crouching in the camp. Ridden lay dead, his throat ripped apart, while another body was being dragged towards a screen of bushes. Galen froze. One beast,
red eyes glinting, reared up on its hind legs and ran silently towards him. Galen shouted a warning and Onik rolled to his feet, his arm flashing back and then forward. His hunting knife shot across the camp to plunge deep into the beast's back. It howled then, rending the night silence. Galen leapt forward, ramming his sword into the beast's chest. Talons lashed at him and he jumped back, releasing the blade. Then Gwalchmai ran forward and hurled his knife, which thudded into the creature's neck. And the clouds closed, darkness blinding them all. Galen dived for his pack, scrabbling at the canvas lip. Delving inside, he produced his tinderbox. There were only a few shredded leaves inside, but he was desperate for light. Twice the sparks jumped, and then a tiny flame licked out. Holding up the box like a flickering candle, Galen turned. He could see Agwain, Onik, and Gwalchmai standing together with swords in hand. On the ground nearby lay the hideous corpse of the dead beast. Elsewhere, there was no sign of the pack. The others joined him, gathering twigs and branches, and they built a fire, heedless of any danger from the Aenir. Agwain took a burning branch and moved to the spot where Lane had slept. The ground was wet with blood, and his body was lying some 20 feet away. Ridden's corpse was nowhere in sight. Galen moved to where Lane lay, and with trembling hands, turned over the corpse. Lane's throat had been ripped away, but his face was untouched, and his grey eyes were open, staring at nothing. Galen sank back. Gwalchmai knelt by the body and reached out, his fingers tenderly brushing the skin of Lane's face.
"Oh, God," said Gwalchmai.
Galen lifted Lane's hand, picturing him as he had been only a few hours before, tall, handsome, and in love.
"I promised to be there for you, and I wasn't," he said. "I am so sorry, Lane." "We must bury him deep," said Agwain. "We can't," said Galen. "The fire will have alerted the Aenir, and the beasts could return at any time. We must push on."
"I'll not have him devoured by those creatures," stormed Agwain.
Galen rose, tears shining in his eyes.
"You think I do not feel exactly the same, Agwain? But Lane is gone. His spirit has fled. All that is left is dead flesh, which, even if we bury it, will be devoured by maggots. The Fallen need us. Lane does not. Now let us move."
"But we don't know where those creatures are," objected Gwalchmai. "We could run right into them."
"And if we don't," snapped Galen, "then by morning we'll all be blood-eagled to the trees." "Galen is right. It's time to move," said Agwain. "Kill the fire."
Donning their packs, they set off towards the east, where the dark line of the Cardul Range could be seen against the sky. They walked with swords in hand, saying little, and the journey was fraught with fear. The storm clouds passed over them, lightning flashing to the south, and the moon shone bright.
"By the gods, look!" exclaimed Gwalchmai.
On either side of them, some 20 paces distant, dark shadows could be seen, moving from bush to bush.
"How many?" hissed Agwain.
4, answered Onik.
Swiftly they doffed their packs, stringing the short hunting bows.
"Wait," said Galen. "Let us each pick a target, for once they learn the power of the bow, they will be more wary."
Gwalchmai eased back on the string.
"All right, I'll take the one on the left at the rear."
Choosing their targets, they waited patiently, Gwalchmai and Onik kneeling, Agwain and Galen facing right, with bows half-drawn. The werebeasts crouched in the bushes, confused and uncertain. They could not see the shining talons that had cut down their comrade, only long sticks of wood, but they were wary. The leader edged forward, raising his head. The scent of warm flesh caused his stomach to tighten, and saliva dripped from his maw. He moved into the open on all fours, edging still closer. A second followed him. On the other side, a third beast was in view. More clouds bunched above them, the sky darkening. Galen cursed.
Let fly! Now! Shafts hissed through the night air. The leader howled as the missile sliced into his chest, spearing his lungs. Blood filled his throat and the howling ceased. Behind him, the second thrashed about in the bushes, an arrow through his eye. To the left, Gwalchmai's target had dropped without a sound, shot through the heart. Only Onik had not let fly. His target had remained in the bushes. Alone and frightened, it sprinted away to the west.
Chapter 10 Taliesin led Caswellan to a long room beneath the Valen Caves. The walls were lined with shelves of old oak, some of them twisted and cracked with age. Upon some of them were parchment scrolls, leather-bound books, and sheaves of paper bound with twine. Others were stacked with metal cylinders or small glass bottles, sealed with wax. On the far side of the hall, two druids were sitting at one of the many tables, poring over scrolls and scribbling notes with quill pens. Magrig, Leofas and Meg were waiting there when the druid and the clansman arrived. While Meg examined the shallow wound in her husband's shoulder, Magrig pressed Caswellan about his journey through the gateway. He told them of the baby and the old man who had been carrying her. As he spoke the old man's name, Taliesin sank to a chair, eyes wide, mouth agape. It was the first time Caswellan had seen him so surprised.
"You did not tell me it was Astolay,"
he whispered.
"Still alive?"
"He's not alive now," said Caswellan. "He died there, in that forest." Taliesin shook his head.
"Unlikely. He had remarkable powers of recuperation," said the druid. "He's twice as old as I am, and I once saw a spear pierce his chest, the point emerging alongside his spine. He made me draw it from him. I did, and watched the wound heal within seconds."
"Alive or dead, he cannot help us now," said Caswellan. "So what do we do?"
"We try again, if you feel strong enough." "Do you? Is there a choice, druid?"
Taliesin shook his head. Magrig loomed over the druid.
"Except that after the last mistake," he said, "you might now waft him away to the center of the Anir camp, and he can demand their surrender."
"It was not a mistake,"
snapped the druid.
"It was destiny."
"Well, if there is a moment of destiny," promised Magrig, "I'll pierce your scrawny ears with your teeth."
"That will be hard to do, after I've turned you to a toad,"
Taliesin countered.
"Enough," said Meg sharply. "Go back to the gate, all of you. I need to speak to my husband."
Magrig swallowed his anger and followed Taliesin and the old warrior Leofas from the room. When they had gone, Meg took Caswellan's hand and looked deep into his sea-green eyes.
"I love you, husband," she said, "more than life. I want so much to ask you, to beg you, to refuse Taliesin. Yet I will not, even though my heart is filled with fears for you."
He nodded, then lifted her hand to his lips.
"You are mine, and I am yours,"
he said.
"You are the finest of women, and I have not the words to tell you what you mean to me."
He fell silent as a single tear rolled to Meg's cheek.
"I love you, Meg. But I must do what I can to save my people."
The clansmen stood, and hand in hand, he and Meg walked to the gate. It stood open, the bright sunshine of another world blazing down upon hills and mountains. Taliesin stood waiting on the other side. Meg kissed Caswellan, and he felt the wetness of her tears on his cheek. Magrig gripped his hand.
"Take care, boy,"
he said gruffly.
Recovering his sword, Caswellan stepped through the archway onto the hillside above Citadel Town.
"Remember, Caswellan," said Taliesin, "the Queen must have her army assembled within 10 days. Take her to the falls where we fought the demons. Tell her Taliesin needs her help."
"You think she will remember you, after all these years?"
"She saw me only yesterday,"
said Taliesin.
"Well, yesterday to her. And now it is time to go. Come back here at dawn in 4 days, and report on your progress."
Leaving the druid behind him, Caswellan set off down the slope towards the city. There were sentries at the gates, but many people were passing through, and the clansman was not challenged. As he walked, Caswellan gazed at the buildings. They were not like the houses of Arteris, being higher and more closely packed, built of red brick and stone, the windows small. There were narrow open sewage channels on both sides of the street, and the stench from them filled the nostrils. Crowds of revellers were gathering on every side, drunken clansmen and mercenaries, many singing, others dancing to the tune of the pipes. Caswellan threaded his way through them, heading for the citadel above the town. At the gates, he was stopped by two guards wearing bronze breastplates and leather kilts. Both carried lances.
"What is your business here?" asked the shorter of the two.
"I seek the Queen," replied Caswellan.
"Many men seek the Queen. Not all are allowed to find her."
"It is a matter of importance,"
said Caswellan.
"I know you," asked the guard. "You seem familiar."
"My business is urgent," said Caswellan.
The man nodded once more, then called a young soldier from the ramparts.
"Take this man to the city hall. Ask for Auberon."
The soldier saluted and walked away. Caswellan followed. The man stopped before a wide flight of marble steps, at the top of which were double doors of bronze-studded oak. Before the doors were 4 more guards in bronze breastplates. Each of these wore crimson cloaks and leather breeches cut short at the calf. The soldier led the way up the stairs and whispered to one of the sentries. The man tapped at the door and passed a message inside. After a wait of several more minutes, the door opened once more, and an officer came out. He was tall and of middle years, his beard iron-grey, his eyes a frosty blue. He looked at Caswellan and smiled. Taking the clansman by the arm, he led him inside the hall.
"The Queen is holding a victory banquet," he said, "but you will not find her in a good mood."
The hall was vast, with 10 high-arched windows. A huge curved table was set at the centre, around which sat more than 200 men and women, feasting on roast pig, swan, goose, chicken, and sundry other meats and pastries. The noise was incredible, and Caswellan found himself longing for the open mountains. Swallowing down his distaste, he followed the officer forward. At the far end of the hall, where the table curved like an upturned horseshoe, sat the Queen. She was a tall woman, silver-haired and yet young, and she wore a plain dress of white wool. Caswellan had seen this woman die in the Farland 3 years before. Then she had been handsome but old. Now she was a beauty, proud and strong, her clear grey eyes sparkling with life and energy. The eyes turned on Caswellan, and Sigani rose from her seat, a delighted smile on her face. She hesitated, as if not believing what she saw. Then she was running to meet Caswellan.
"Red Hawk," she shouted joyously. "You've returned."
Caswellan returned the Queen's embrace, his mind racing as Sigani gripped his shoulders.
"Let me look at you, Red Hawk. By heaven, how is it you've become young again? Have you dyed that beard? It was almost pure silver the last time we met."
"I hear you've done well," counted Caswellan, his mind racing.
"Well? Now that is an understatement. The Outland King is slain, his army in ruins. The war may not be won, but we have gained valuable time. Time! Morgasa is defeated, but she has vanished. Not one word of her in 6 months. But enough of that.
Where have you been these last 2 years? I needed you.
I have been in my own land, amongst my own people.
You are ill at ease, my friend. What ails you?
I am merely tired, my lady.
She smiled.
Join us at table. We'll eat and hear a few songs, said Tsigane, leading him forward. Later, we'll talk.
The feast seemed to last an eternity, and great was his relief when eventually it ended. A servant led him to an upper bedchamber. It was small, with a single window and a long pallet bed. A fire was burning in the hearth. Moving to the window, Caswellan pushed it open and gazed out over the mountains. Confused, he remembered again the queen's death near Attafos and her last words.
No, the circle is complete,
the queen had said,
for you told me you would be with me at my death.
And then at last she had asked,
was I truly the queen you desired me to be?
The cold winds of approaching winter made him shiver. Closing the window, he crossed the room to sit on the rug before the fire. He thought he had been prepared for anything, but the sight of the queen had shaken him. She was stunningly beautiful, and despite his love for Meg, he found in himself a yearning for Tsigane which he would not have believed possible. For some time he sat there, then felt the draught on his back as the door opened. Tsigane entered. She was dressed now in a simple woolen shirt of white that showed the curve of her breasts, and dark brown leggings which highlighted her long, slim legs. She sat down on the bed. No more the queen, she looked now like a clanswoman, tall and strong, fearless and free. Her mouth was astonishingly inviting, and Caswellan found his heart beating wildly.
"What are you thinking, my wizard?"
she asked, her voice more husky than he recalled from her greeting in the hall.
"You are very beautiful, lady. And you are changed," she said softly, her grey eyes holding to his gaze.
"In what way?" he countered. Tsigane slid off the bed to sit next to him by the fire.
When I greeted you, I saw the surprise in your eyes, and now I am here beside you, and yet you do not seek to hold me. What has happened to you, Red Hawk? Have you forsaken me for another? I will understand if that is true. By heaven, I have said my share of farewells to lovers. I would hope to have the strength to accept similar treatment. Is that what is happening here?
No.
He said, his mind reeling. Moving back from her, he stood and returned to the window. The moon was high over the mountains, and he stared up at the sky, fighting to make sense of her words.
They were lovers? How could this be? For Caswellan, loyalty was not like a cloak to be worn or discarded, but an iron code to live by. And yet...
Talk to me, Red Hawk, said Tsigane. He swung to face her. Once more her beauty struck him like an arrow.
Taliesin told me that you understood the gateways. You know, therefore, that they allow us to move through time as well as to other lands?
Of course, she told him. What has that to do with you and me?
He took a deep breath.
In all my life, I have seen you only 4 times. Once as a babe in the forest, the second time by Ironhand's Falls, the third... He hesitated and looked away. In my own realm. And the fourth, tonight in the Great Hall. Everything you say to me about us is new and strange. If we are to be lovers, it is not now but in a time, for me, that is yet to be. As I stand here, I have a wife, Meg, whom I adore, and a small child, Donal. He saw she was about to speak and raised his hand. Please, say nothing, for I know I would never betray Meg while she lived,
and I do not want to know what the future holds for her."
Sigarni rose, her face thoughtful. "You are a good man, Red Hawk, and I love you. I will say nothing of Meg." She smiled.
"Just as you hesitated about our meeting in your own realm. I will leave you now. We will talk in the morning."
"Wait,"
he called out as she opened the door. "There is something I must ask of you."
"The debt?"
she said. Then, noting his incomprehension, she smiled softly. "You always said there would come a time when you would ask me a great favor. Whatever it is, I will grant it. Good night, Red Hawk."
"You are a rare woman, Sigarni."
Turning back, she nodded.
"You will one day say that to me with even more feeling," she promised.
Taliesin sat alone in the semi-darkness of his viewing chamber. It was cold, and idly he touched a switch to his right. Warm air flowed through hidden steel vents in the floor, and he removed his cloak. Leaning back against the headrest of the padded leather chair, he stared at the panelled ceiling. His mind tired, his thoughts fragmented. He transferred his gaze to the gleaming files. 800 years of notes, discoveries, failures, and triumphs. Useless. All of it. How could the great gates have closed? And why were the middle gates shrinking year by year? The Infinity Code had been broken a century before his birth by the scientist Astolay. The first gate, the window really, had been set up the following year. It had seemed then that the universe itself had shrunk to the size of a small room. By the time Taliesin was a student, his people had seen every star, every minor planet. Gates had been erected on thousands of sites from Sirius to Septatua. Linear time had snapped back into a Gordian knot of interwoven strands. It was a time of soaring arrogance and interstellar jests. Taliesin himself had walked upon many planets as a god, enjoying immensely the worship of the planet-bound humanoids. But as he grew older, such cheap entertainment palled, and he became fascinated by the development of man. Astolay, his revered teacher, had fallen from grace, becoming convinced of some mystic force outside human reality. Mocked and derided, he had left the Order and vanished from the outer world. Yet it was he who had first saved the baby Sigarni. Taliesin felt a sense of relief. For years he had feared a rogue element amid the complexities of his plans. Now that fear vanished. He understood now the riddle of the hawk eternal.
"You and I will teach him, Astolay," he said, "and we will save my people."
A nagging pain fled in his left arm, and rubbing his bicep, he rose from the chair.
"Now I must find you, old friend," he said. "I shall begin by revisiting the last place Caswellan saw you."
His fingers spasmed as a new pain lanced into his chest. Taliesin staggered to his chair, fear welling within him. He scrabbled for a box on the desktop, spilling its contents. Tiny capsules rolled to the floor. With trembling fingers he reached for them. There was a time when he would have needed no crudely manufactured remedies, no digitalis derived from foxglove. In the days of the Great Gates, he would have travelled to places where his weakened heart would have been regenerated within an hour. Youth within a day. But not now. His vision swam. The fear became a tidal wave of panic that circled his chest with a band of fire.
"Oh, please," he begged. "Not now."
The floor rose to strike his head, pain swamping him.
"Just one more day," he groaned.
His fingers clenched into a fist as a fresh spasm of agony ripped into him, and as he died, the gates vanished. During the week that followed Caswellan's departure, Magrig led his Palades warriors on a series of killing raids
hitting the Aenir at night, peppering them with arrows from woods and forests. Leofas, with 400 Farland clansmen, circled the Aenir force and attacked from the south. Whenever the Aenir mustered for a counterattack, the clans melted away, splitting their groups to reform at agreed meeting places. The raids were no more than a growing irritation to Asbedag, despite the disruption of his supply lines and the loss of some 300 warriors. The main battle was what counted, and the clans could not run forever. But where was Barsa? Nothing had been heard of his son and the timber wolves he led. Drada trapped a raiding party of 20 Palades warriors in a wood 12 miles from Atafos, and these, bar one, were summarily butchered. The prisoner was tortured for 7 hours, but revealed nothing. He had been blood-eagled on a wide tree. But the main force, led by Magrig, escaped to the north, cutting through the ring of steel Drada had thrown around the wood. Still, 20 of the enemy had been slain, and Drada was not displeased. In the southeast, Galen and his companions had found more than 80 Palades warriors in the caves of Pateron, a day's march from Caduil. These he had persuaded to march with him on his return. It was a start. On the fifth day of travel, Galen and his group entered the thick pines below Carduil, and as they climbed, they felt the chill of the wind blowing down from the snow-capped peaks. As they neared the opening to a narrow pass, a tall woman, in leather breeches and a hooded sheepskin jerkin, stepped out from the trees, a bow half-drawn in her hands.
"Halt! Where you stand?" she commanded.
"We are seeking Laric," Galen told the clanswoman.
"Who are you?"
"Galen of the Farlan. I come with a message from the warlord Caswellan and his friend Magrig of the Palades." The warrior woman eased down the bowstring, returned the shaft to the quiver, and moved forward.
"I am Lara," she said, holding out her hand. "Laric's daughter. My father is dead. He led the men on a raid to Asgard. They were taken and slain to the last man."
"All dead?" asked Agwain, pushing forward.
"Yes. The Hasten are finished."
"I am sorry," said Galen, his heart sinking.
"No more than we are," said Lara. "We are camped within Carduil. Join us."
The companions followed her into the pass, and up to the winding trail below the caves. Once within the twisted caverns, Lara pushed back her hood, shaking loose her dark hair. Leaving the companions at a fire where food was being prepared, she took Galen to a small rough-cut chamber, in which lay a bed and a table of pine.
"There used to be a group of druids here," she said, stripping off her jerkin.
Tossing it to the bed, she pulled a chair from beneath the table and sat. Galen sat on the bed, his misery evident.
"You thought you'd find an army?" she asked softly.
"Yes."
"How many Farlan warriors escaped?"
"Close to 4,000.
"And Palades?"
"Less than 1,000.
"They'll fight well," said the girl. "Would you like something to drink?"
Galen nodded. She stood and crossed the chamber, bending to lift a jug and 2 goblets from behind a wooden chest. The soft leather of her breeches stretched across her hips. Galen blinked and looked away, suddenly uncomfortable. She passed him a goblet of honeyed wine.
"Are you warm?"
she asked.
"A little. Your face is flushed. Take your jerkin off."
She really was quite striking, he realized, as he removed the garment. Her eyes were the blue of an evening sky, her mouth wide and full-lipped.
"Why are you staring?"
"I'm sorry," he stammered.
"I saw you run in the games," she said. "You were unlucky to miss the final."
"Luck had little to do with it," he said, happier to be on firmer ground.
"I heard you were attacked. Still, the clans won."
"Yes, they will win again." "At this moment, I don't see how," said Galen. "Nothing has gone right for us. We have lost thousands,
and the Aenir are hardly touched. I have 800 warriors at my command, she said.
What? Where are you hiding them?
They're not hidden, they're here with me.
You mean the women?
If that patronizing look does not fade soon, you Farland Pigswell, then you'll be leaving here faster than you came.
I apologize, he said.
Well, stop apologizing, she snapped. It seems you've done nothing else since you arrived. You're the lowlander Caswellan brought home, are you not?
I am.
Then this once, I will forgive you for not thinking like a clansman. All our women are skilled with the bow. We can also use knives, though swords are a little unwieldy. Our men are dead, and our clan finished. We none of us have any reason to go on living like beasts in the mountains. Even if we survive and smash the Aenir, there will be no hasten. Our day is gone. The best we can hope for is to find husbands from other clans. Believe me, Galen, that is not a happy thought.
Let us start again, Lara, he said. I did not wish to insult you, and though I was once a lowlander, I am well aware of the skill of clan women. I will accept your offer, if you still hold to it. You must forgive me. It has been a long spring, and much has happened. I have been hunted, attacked, and seen my closest friends slain. The enemy that has destroyed your people did this to me when I was a child in Arteris, he told her, pointing to the blood-red eye and the jagged white scar above. I had few friends in that city, but those were brutally murdered. Youngsters I grew to like among the fallen are now rotting corpses. I was sent here to gather an army that could descend upon the enemy and perhaps turn the tide of battle. I do not patronize you. I admire you. But still, I am disappointed.
That I can understand, she said, her voice softening. You were one of the beast slayers, were you not? That seems so long ago now. There were five of us, and one of those lies dead back in the forest, or at least he would, had he not been devoured by another demon beast.
Who died? She asked.
Lane. The handsome brother of the mighty Lennox, she said. That is indeed a loss. You see, there are more of these creatures, still roaming the mountains.
Only one. We slew the others.
Good, she said with a smile. You know you are now part of clan myths.
He nodded.
A small part. The Lowlander and the Ghost Queen.
Is that what they call her?
Yes. The story is that she was the daughter of Eris, returned from the grave.
I don't know about that, he told her. Her name was Sigarni, and she was a mighty warrior queen, the sort of woman you would follow into the caverns of the damned.
I like the sound of her.
I'll get her something to eat, she said, rising and taking his empty goblet. Tell me, he asked suddenly, was your man killed?
I had no man.
Why?
What business is it of yours? And don't apologize.
He watched her leave the chamber, too aware for comfort of her sensual grace and the sleek lines of her body. Magrig was horrified when the young druid Metis brought in the news of Taliesin's death. The Paladin's leader was still reeling from the trap that had been sprung on him that morning when the Aenir encircled his force. He had escaped, but only by good fortune. Now he was thunderstruck. He sent a message to Leofas and retired with Intosh to the forest caves to await him. It was late afternoon when Leofas was led to him. With the old warrior was his giant son, Lennox.
You have heard?
Asked Magrick, rising and gripping the old man's hand.
Yes.
Leofas was grey with fatigue, and he slumped to the ground beside the crackling fire.
How could it happen?
He asked.
Damned if I know. Druid magic.
Taliesin was found dead in his chambers. They'd run to him to report the disappearance of the gates. Metis tells me they've tried all the words of power, but none work anymore. All our women and children gone. Caswellan trapped in another land. God, it is hopeless,
said Leofas.
The Druids are searching through Taliesin's records. So far, they've achieved nothing.
Leofas rubbed his face, scratching at his iron-streaked beard.
It seems as if the gods are riding with the Indir. Let them,
said Magrig.
I've never had a lot of time for them. A man stands alone in his life. If he stops to rely on some invisible spirit, then he'll feel.
Luck has a way of changing,
said Intosh.
I don't believe we should do anything rash. We must proceed with the original plan.
And commit suicide?
Asked Magrig.
The whole point of the Axter strategy was so that Caswellan could bring the Queen's army down on the enemy. Without that, we'll be wiped out within the morning.
They could still reopen the gates,
said Lennox.
I wouldn't trust those Druids to open a pouch,
snapped Magrig.
It's hard to have faith in a group so prone to panic. Metis doesn't know his buttocks from a lump of cheese. And as for the rest, they're running around like headless chickens, so I'm told. If they reopen them in time, we'll stay with Caswellan's plan. If not, we must think again.
There's worse news,
said Lennox. The three men turned to him.
We caught an Anir scout last night. He told us that Laric and his Hasten launched an attack on Asgard. They were repulsed and trapped in Southwood by Orser and 2,000 Anir, and were all slain. Laric's head was left on a spear. There will be no help from the south.
Well, that's about it,
said Magrig.
All we need is a plague in our ranks and the day will be complete.
The four sat in silence round the fire, the burden of despair weighing them down. A young Palades warrior entered the cave. The Loder Huntlord has arrived, he said.
Bring him to me.
I need no bringing,
said Dunild, pushing past the young warrior. The newcomer was short but powerfully built. He had no beard, and his yellow hair hung to his shoulders beneath a woolen bonnet edged with leather and decorated with an eagle's feather. Magrig stood and forced a smile.
Well met, you poaching rascal.
Dunild laid his round shield on the ground and gripped Magrig's wrist.
You look fat and old, Magrig,
said the Loder Huntlord.
That's because I am old and fat. It's still a match for most men, including you. How many follow you?
300.
Good news. I hear you've been suffering. I've had better days,
admitted Magrig.
What of Gregor? I know nothing of the thieving louth,
hissed Dunald.
Now that is not the whole truth, my friend,
said Magrig,
for you'd not have brought your clan and left your own valley unprotected.
Dunald grinned.
He says he will come and fight alongside you, as long as he doesn't have to fight alongside me.
How many will he bring?
He'll match me man for man. So I told him 500.
I trust neither of you will leave any behind to raid each other's lands.
On the contrary, we've both done just that.
I think you might be right, Intosh,
said Magrig.
Perhaps our luck is changing.
The swordsman grinned, and the newcomer joined them round the fire. The discussion carried on into the night, and the men were joined by Patris Grigor, a skeletally lean, balding warrior, and huntlord to the Grigor clan. There were few better sword-killers in the mountains than this taciturn clansman. He sat as far from Dunald as he could, and the two men exchanged not a word during the discussion, all comments directed at Leofas or Magrig. The atmosphere was tense. At dawn they received a report from the Druid Metas. There had been no success with the gates, and Taliesin's files had offered no solution. The gates, he said, were closed forever. For a time none of the leaders spoke. Their families gone. Their hopes dashed. They sat in the silence of despair. Finally, Leofas said,
All we have left now is to die and take as many of the enemy with us as we can. Now is the time for a decision, Margreg. Axe the Glen is out of the question. So where do we make a stand?
His words hung in the air. Margreg, forcing his mind from thoughts of Meg and his grandson, lost in time, glanced at Dunhild and Grigor. These men had brought their warriors to fight alongside the other clans, not to throw their lives away. Margreg saw the concern on their faces, and he knew what other thoughts would be stirring in their cunning minds. The Farlan and the Palladies had lost all their women and children. If, by some chance, they were able to destroy the Aenir, they would then be forced to raid for women from other clans.
"We will find a way to open the gates," he said, surprised at the confidence in his voice. "And more than that, I don't intend merely to lash out like a dying bear. I want to win. By the gods, we are all clansmen here, brothers and cousins. Together we will destroy Asbadag and his ragtag band of killers."
"A pretty speech, Margreg," said Dunhild softly. "But who and where will this be achieved?"
"That is for us to decide at this meeting," answered Margreg. "Who will begin?"
An hour of discussion followed, as the clan leaders suggested various possible battle sites, mostly occupying high ground. None of the sites offered even the possibility of a victory. Then Intosh suggested a mountain pass some 20 miles east. It was known as Icairn's Folly, following a battle there hundreds of years ago when a young chieftain had followed his enemy into the pass and been destroyed.
"We could man the pass walls with archers and lure the Aenir in upon us," said Intosh. "The mountain walls narrow into 250 paces apart at the centre, and a small fosse could hold a larger."
"And what when we are pushed back? The pass is blocked, and we would be like cattle in a slaughter pen,"
said Margreg.
"Let's not be pushed back,"
said Intosh.
"But can we win there?"
asked Grigor.
"I don't like the idea of hurling my clan to doom on one battle."
"Can we win anywhere?" asked Leofas.
"The Folly does have one advantage," offered Margreg. "Our archers will wreak a terrible slaughter among the enemy. The Aenir could break and run. They've done it before, when the Palladies crushed them."
"Even so, is it wise," asked Dunhild, "to choose a battle site with no avenue of retreat?"
"All other areas are ruled out," said Intosh. "Although we cannot retreat, they cannot encircle us." "We could continue to hit and run,"
suggested Lennox, who'd remained silent for much of the planning.
"But we can't win that way," said his father. "I hate to admit it, but it seems we have run out of choices. I vote for Icairn's Folly."
The other leaders nodded. Then Grigor spoke.
"This is your war, Margreg, not mine. I have come because we are all clan, but I'll not watch my men cut to pieces. My archers will man the left-hand slope of the pass. If you are crushed, we can still escape."
"What more could be expected from the Grigors?" snapped Dunhild.
Patrice Grigor started to rise, reaching for his sword, but Margreg stopped him with a raised hand.
"Enough,"
he said.
"Patrice is entirely correct, Dunhild. You and your load of warriors will hold the right-hand slopes, Patrice the left. The Palladies and the Farlan will stand together at the centre. If we are pushed back or scattered, the rest of you must get away with as many men as you can. Take to your own lands. But for the sake of all clansmen, do not go back to war with one another, for your lands will be next, I think."
"We are decided, then?"
asked Leofas.
"It seems so,"
said Margreg. Caswellan's first realization that anything was wrong came early on the fourth morning of his stay in Citadel, Borrowing a horse, he rode into the hills, seeking Taliesin and the gate. He was anxious to hear of the Aenir advance. When he arrived at the slope, he found no entrance. At first he was unconcerned and returned to the city, spending the day with Sigani, listening as she talked warmly of her youth and the early days of her rule, days of bloody war and treachery, and close encounters with disaster. Through the conversations, Caswellan's appreciation of the Queen grew. She was a natural tactician, but more than this, knew men, their strengths and weaknesses, and what drove them. She had a close-knit band of followers, fanatically loyal, led by the powerful Obrin, the Queen's captain, a man of iron strength and innate cunning. Sigani talked of a black general called Asmodeir, who had died holding the rearguard against the Earl of Yaskai and his army, and of a dwarf named Balistar who had journeyed through a gateway in the company of Ironhand's ghost. But of the Red Hawk she had known, she said little, save that he had appeared following the death of Asmodeir, and had helped her to train her men, leading the left wing against Yastai and his thousands.
"Do I have friends here?"
he asked. "Apart from me," she countered with a quick smile. "Who would need more? But yes, there is Obrin. You and he became sword brothers. I think he is a little hurt that you've spent so little time with him." The Queen had agreed to lead her warriors into the Farlan, but said she could gather only 4,000. The call went out, and the muster began. At dawn, Caswellan tried again to find the gate. This time an edge of anger pricked him. What was Taliesin doing closing the gate at such a time? Taking supplies for 3 days, he rode north to the great falls of Attafos. Leaving the horse tethered on a grassy meadow, he swam across the Isle of Valon and entered the deep honeycomb of caves beneath the hill. Near the entrance, he was met by an elderly druid he had seen with Taliesin. "Why has the gate been closed?" asked Caswellan. The man wrung his hands. His face was pinched and tight as if he had not slept for days.
"I don't know," he wailed. "Nothing works anymore, not one word of power."
"What does this mean?"
"The middle and lesser gates have vanished, just like the great gates of yesteryear. We are trapped here. Forever."
"I will not accept that," said Caswellan, fighting down the panic threatening to overwhelm him. "No, be calm, and tell me about the words of power."
The man nodded and sank back on his narrow cot bed, staring at his hands. Caswellan's enforced calm soothed his own panic, and he took a deep breath.
"The words themselves are meaningless. It is the sound of the words. The sounds activate devices set within the hillside here. It is not dissimilar to whistling for a hunting dog, which responds to sounds and reacts as it has been trained to do. Only here we are dealing with something vastly more complex and infinitely beyond our comprehension."
"Something is broken," said Caswellan lamely.
"Indeed it is. But we are talking about a device created eons ago by a superior race whose skills we can scarce guess at. I, myself, have seen devices no bigger than the palm of my hand, inside which are 1,000 separate working parts. We do not even have the tools to work upon these devices, and if we did, we would not know where to start."
"So we cannot contact Taliesin?"
asked Caswellan.
"No. Just pray he is working towards a solution on the other side."
"Are you one of the original druids?"
The man laughed.
"No, my grandfather was. I am Sestra of the Hasten."
"Are there any of the elder race on this side of the gate?"
"None that I know of."
Caswellan thanked him and returned to the mare. 2 days later, weary to the inner depths of his soul, he rode back into Citadel town. Not to see Meg again, and feel the touch of her lips on his. Not to see Donal grow into a fine man, never to know the fate of his people, doomed to walk the rest of his life in a foreign land under strange stars. He sought the Queen,
finding her in her private rooms at the east wing of the hall. He told her nothing of the disappearance of the gates, but questioned her about the priest who had first brought her to the forest as a babe.
"What of him?"
asked Sigarni.
"Did he survive?"
"You know that he did."
"I am tired, my lady, and my brain is weary. Forgive me.
Does he still live?" is what I meant.
"Only just, my love. He is the abbot of the Dark Woods, a day's journey to the east. But the last I heard, he was blind and losing his wits."
"Can you spare a man to take me to him?"
"Of course. Is it important?"
"More important than I want to think about," said Caswellan.
With two horses each, Caswellan and a rider named Bedwyr rode through the day, reaching the Dark Woods an hour after dark. Both men reeled from their saddles, and Bedwyr hammered at the door of the monastery. It was opened by a sleepy monk whose eyes filled with fear as he saw the armour worn by the riders.
"Be at peace, man," said Bedwyr. "We're not raiders. We ride for the queen. Does the abbot live?"
The man nodded, and led them through narrow corridors of cold stone to a small cell facing west. He did not tap upon the door, but opened it quietly, leading them inside. A lantern flickered upon the far wall, throwing shadows to a wide bed, in which lay a man of great age, his eyes open, seeming to stare at the rough-cut ceiling.
"Leave us," ordered Caswellan.
Bedwyr escorted the monk from the room, and Caswellan heard the rider asking for food, and the monk's promise that he would find bread and honey. Caswellan walked forward and sat beside the abbot. He had changed much since Caswellan first saw him. His face was webbed with age, and his sightless eyes seemed preternaturally bright.
"Can you hear me?" asked the lay.
Asked Caswellan. The man stirred.
"I hear you, Red Hawk, my friend. There's fear in your voice."
"Yes, great fear. I need your help now, as once you needed mine in the forest."
The man chuckled weakly.
"There is no magic left, Red Hawk. With all the wonders my mind encompassed, I can now no longer lift this pitiful frame from the bed, nor see the brighter sunset. By tomorrow, I shall have joined my lord.
The gates have closed."
"That is ancient history.
The middle gates."
"Again? That is not possible."
"Believe me, Astley, they have closed. How may I reopen them?"
"Wait a moment,"
said the old man.
"When did you last see me?"
"You were in the forest with the infant queen."
"Ah, I understand," said Astley. "It is so long since I played with time, and my mind is growing addled."
His head sank back on the pillow, and he closed his sightless eyes.
"Yes, 'tis becoming clear. The Fallen is still under threat. The queen has not yet passed the gate, and you have yet to learn the mysteries."
"I have it now."
"Then help me," urged Caswellan. "Tell me how to reopen the gate. I must lead the queen through, or my people will perish."
"I cannot tell you, my boy. I can only show you, teach you. It will take many years. 11, if I remember correctly."
"I don't have years," said Caswellan, hope draining from him.
The old man was senile and making no sense. As if reading his mind, Astley reached out a hand and gripped Caswellan's arm, and when he spoke, his voice was strong with authority.
"Do not despair, my friend. There's much that you cannot understand. I made the gates in my youth and arrogance,
had discovered the lines of power that link the myriad pasts, the parallel worlds, and I made the machines to track them and ride them. It was I who allowed the